RadioInfluence.com.
This is Landry Football on Radio Influence, the only podcast where you can get perspective of what happened on the gridiron through the eyes of a coach, scout, and front office administrator. Now, it's time to step into the film room. Here's Chris Landry.
And it is Tuesday, November 9th. Welcome into the Landry Football Podcast. Every Tuesday and Thursday, you can catch us here as we break down the world of college football and the NFL on LandryFootball.com, as well as all your ways, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and anywhere else that you catch these podcasts. Be sure to check us out at LandryFootball.com for all the latest news and notes, film breakdowns on the college and pro game. Got a lot to get to today. Got a couple of questions we're going to answer. We've got a lot to respond to from this weekend of college football and the NFL, and we're going to get to it. I want to start, though, a little bit from the NFL standpoint, because it is fresh from last night's impressive performance by the New Orleans Saints and the star of the show, no doubt, Drew Brees, as he becomes the leading passer in pro football history. It's only one touchdown away, by the way, and he'll get it this next week. Excuse me, bye week this week. The next game when he will become join Tom Brady, who threw 500 touchdown passes, reached that milestone last Thursday night. Want to talk a little bit about what Drew Brees, a little bit of his background, and what a godsend he's been for the city of New Orleans, the region, the Gulf Coast region. And some of it was, you know, I thought very well done on television, but maybe provide some information that you're not as familiar with. From Drew Brees and growing up in Texas, he was a really good athlete, played all sports, a great foot quickness, beat Andy Roddick in youth tennis. Just was a good all-around athlete, big-time competitor. As you know, went to Purdue because he was not recruited, highly recruited, by some of the big schools. And you saw Joe Tiller take him at Purdue and really develop him into a really nice player. Joe Tiller, in many ways, is ahead of his time in terms of how he taught offenses. And with a competitive, smart player like Drew Brees, it was tremendously successful. I know that people are aware that he played at Purdue. I don't think people are as familiar with how well he played at Purdue, how good he was, how difficult he was to defend. And scouting and you know, watching him, I know that the coaches in the Big Ten just dreaded playing him. He had tremendous success, even against a Nick Saban coach defense at Michigan State. It was very, very challenging. Very, very challenging to play against. He was always someone that maximized his abilities because of his smarts, because of his foot quickness. He found his way to get good throwing lanes because of his quick feet, and he also saw the field very well. The biggest thing physically that he had working for him was that explosiveness from under center or out of shotgun. He could get greater depth quicker, which gave him a better survey of the field, and then step up in it with keeping his eyes downfield and feeling the pressure. That combination was incredible. His anticipatory skills was always advanced. Wasn't as good at Purdue as he is now, of course, but he anticipated better than others relative to the same stages of their career. Just simply outstanding. When he came out in the draft, like a lot of folks, a lot of people liked him, but maybe weren't crazy about him. I think you saw the height issue. Some people weren't as, certainly not as, no one saw him being what he is today. But it's a testament to his hard work, and it's a testament to what type of competitor he is. If you look at guys whose careers finish by injuries, it's a pretty sad state of the volatility of this position in this game. But I'd like to talk, you know, a little bit about a couple of things, first of all, before I get into more Drew Brees. It's a sign, and a positive sign, for all the negativity with injuries and whatnot. The advances that we've made in the medical areas are extraordinary. And it is career-saving for a lot of these players. For example, you've heard me tell the story about Greg Cook, Cincinnati quarterback, University of Cincinnati quarterback, drafted by the hometown Cincinnati Bengals. As talented a quarterback as you'll ever see, ever in any era. Big, strong, athletic, had everything. Bill Walsh, who was the coach for Paul Brown at the time, said he's the best quarterback he ever saw. I've told this story, but it's something to, it's apropos with Drew Brees's, what he's been able to overcome. Greg had a really, well, he was as good as a quarterback in the was in the league. Rookie of the year, and was as good as any quarterback in the league. What we are talking about with Patrick Mahomes right now is what Greg Cook was, and he did it for an entire year. Suffered an injury to his shoulder. It was a rotator cuff tear. But they didn't know it back then. This was before they had those type of surgeries. Certainly before they could go in with a scope and look at it and see. So it just was a sore shoulder to him and to the team. So he played the next year with a torn rotator cuff. And I'll tell you how they figured that out. And they figured it out later on when they went in and did the surgery. They realized it was torn completely off. But he played an entire season with a torn rotator cuff. He was MVP of the league. He was beyond good. He was great. But because of that, and they didn't recognize it, they couldn't figure it out, couldn't fix it, his career was over. So once he pushed that to the limit, then it certainly killed his future. So let's tie this to Drew Brees. He damages his shoulder severely. He gets it operated on. The rehab is arduous. Just the rehab alone tells you the competitiveness, the character, the work ethic that Drew Brees has. Most are not coming back from that injury, maybe ever. He did. The injury was so severe. The expectations so low that doctors around the league at the time, Nick Saban, it's at Alabama, and I'm doing consulting work for him and that team. So I was on conference calls firsthand, heard this firsthand. Nick, obviously, a lot of people like Drew Brees, like what he did in San Diego before getting injured. Then Phillip Rivers comes in. The injury was considered so severe that not only team doctors, it's well noted that the doctors with the Dolphins rejected him, said he's not going to be able to come back from this injury. But here's what is not known. Nick Saban, after hearing from his doctors, who has a personal connection with Dr. James Andrews. By now, most of you know who Dr. James Andrews is. He's a renowned orthopedic surgeon, considered the best in the country, is in Alabama, but is an LSU graduate. There's a connection. First of all, everyone has a connection with Dr. Andrews. Every team in the league, college programs around the country, send their kids to Dr. Andrews to have them looked at. But there's a special connection because Dr. Andrews, who's noted as an Alabama and Auburn, you know, team physician and Redskins and whatnot, again, has a connection to LSU, knows Nick Saban. So he sends Drew Brees back to Dr. Andrews. Dr. Andrews was the guy that did the surgery on Drew Brees. Has a connection with Nick Saban. Dr. Andrews said, I would not take Drew Brees. I don't think he's coming back. Now, I love Dr. Andrews, thinks the world of him. Dr. Andrews has told people, oh, no, I told people he was going to come back. It's not true. I heard Dr. Andrews myself on a conference call say, chances of him coming back and throwing the football at an NFL level again is very minimal. There's the exact words. Still got it in my notes. So even Dr. Andrews, the very best orthopedic surgeon and the guy that did the surgery, you know, a lot of times guys, there may be experts, but if they don't do the surgery, they're not as familiar with the situation. This is the guy that did the surgery. This is the guy that's the best said it's not likely to happen for him. Drew Brees, not getting an offer from Miami, committed to being fully healed and recovered, going to do everything it takes. Signs with the Saints, who had just hired a head coach, Sean Payton, who wanted the Green Bay Packer job. So Sean is wanting the Green Bay Packer job. He loses that to Mike McCarthy. He settles. He was excited about the Saints job, but needed a quarterback, and they get Drew Brees. The Saints get Drew Brees. They get Sean Payton, basically because the Packers and the Dolphins passed on both. Meanwhile, in New Orleans, under a new regime, hiring new coach, or coming off the horrific events of Hurricane Katrina, the city was so devastated, was completely torn apart. There are still parts, folks, that never were rebuilt. To put it in perspective for people who don't understand, if you look at your lavatory in your bathroom, and if you know the little drain stopper, imagine the drain stopper. That's New Orleans. That's how much under sea level there are. And imagine the dams breaking and the water rushing in and destroying the city. It was so bad that New Orleans native, New Orleans own Tom Benson, the owner, heard him stand up in an owner's meeting in tears, saying, "I'm going to need help moving this team. There will be no New Orleans to move back to. We will not survive as a city there. It will not make it. There won't be people to go. This city is absolutely destroyed. People are moving out. There's no place to come back to. This is going to be a city that's going to be just for a few." Pardon me. And we're not going to have enough to support this team. He, with a huge business interest in San Antonio, wanted to move the team to San Antonio. Jerry Jones fought that, had a lot of clout in the league. That and the fact that Paul Tagliabue, the commissioner at the time, did not want to have on his watch a member of the league leave a city that just had been destroyed by devastation. That would have been a bad PR look, no doubt. But it was that and the pushback of not wanting a team in San Antonio. So as things start to settle in, there's one reason and one reason only that the Superdome was repaired. First of all, it was in an awful way a godsend because the Superdome needed massive repairs to begin with. The infrastructure, the wiring and whatnot. Well, the Superdome, devastated by Hurricane Katrina, got federal funding to rebuild it. And so it's not the state providing it. It's not, you know, the team having to pony up money. It's federal money provided to the state to make repairs, and one of them was to the Superdome. So the Superdome gets a massive facelift. It's certainly, from a bones structure, as good of a place you can get. But it was just destroyed with water and just the disaster of taking apart all the infrastructure inside of it. They gutted everything and they rebuilt everything. Rebuilt it all, the wiring and the more suites, and they did it upright. And they made it like a new stadium. But it was a tough go for a while, playing in San Antonio, playing in Baton Rouge, and it was a mess. But as the stadium is, again, the bones of the thing are done, as they repair the outside and then just kind of redo the whole inside, it is done, it's done well, and it is the symbol for New Orleans that we're not dead and we're coming back. You know, again, different. People compare Katrina to 9/11. Well, they're different. One's an attack on our freedom, and it was an emotional disaster. But the infrastructure of building the Twin Towers, the cleanup affected people, but it wasn't, it was an emotional effect. Katrina was, it just devastated a whole city. There was just things that just were no longer there. Everything had to be rebuilt, just phone lines and towers and you name it, all the infrastructure just destroyed. Well, the Superdome became the symbol for rebuild, symbol for we're going to be alive. We're going to live again as a city. Then they signed this Sean Payton and his head coach. Drew Brees comes in. And, you know, no one at that point thought this was going to have the type of impact. But I can tell you that as the city began to gradually get back together, when they opened up the Superdome, and I think people still remember it, it was a Monday night game, just like last night. But it was unlike anything I've ever heard or seen or felt. When they opened up that city, by opening up the dome again, it was a we've returned. And everyone remembers that game. I remember it being there. Steve Gleason, who's tragically dealing with ALS, blocks the punt. And literally, and I don't mean this, figuratively, it felt like the roof was going to come off the stadium. The noise just bounced off to a decibel level that I've never heard. And the excitement level was incredible. I still remember Sean Payton telling me that he brought the team in. There was a, if you remember, there was a, what's the band? Is it, I'm an ignorant when it comes to music. I think it's U2. I may be wrong on the name. I apologize. They had a song written, "The Saints Are Coming" or "Saints Are Coming Back" or what have you. And that was a part of it. There was a special presentation that was put in. Sean Payton, who's very underrated as a motivator, by the way. He's a great play caller. He brought the team in, and they practice on Friday for the Monday night game. And he had his team sit down at the Superdome. And he had the presentation, the honorarium, everything played for him, which was played at the stadium on Monday night. It was so emotional. And the players watched it, looked in a starry-eyed glance. And Sean told them, this is going to be the biggest game you've ever played in your life. More so than any Super Bowl. What it means to the city, what it means to you as a member of this city, this will be the most important game you've ever played. And as they got up to left, he says, but it only if you win. And I think Sean knew at that time that there wasn't any chance in hell the Falcons had in that game. And I'm not one of these folks that believe a whole lot into, I believe crowds have an effect and all that. That's great. But it's still about players and executing. But that emotion level was so high. And why I'm bringing back that point is this was the start of something that almost felt like a preordained thing. It was just something like, just was going to happen. It was supposed to happen. Just seemed like it was meant to be. So we know that they continued to get better. Then obviously went on the Super Bowl run, which was very magical. That was a type of year. You look at every team's Super Bowl year, and there's great play combined with some magic that just seems to be good breaks. Injury-wise, breaks in games, and that's the way it was in the Saints Super Bowl year. But the reason why I'm bringing back and kind of some ways going back memory lane is this all was a part of what I thought was the signing of Drew Brees being a godsend. Everything that they said on the telecast, I can firsthand vouch for. Drew Brees is as down-to-earth, true hero as you're ever going to meet. Dyed-in-the-wool belief in veterans. He has put tons of money into the World War II Veterans Museum. Grandfather was a vet. Just absolutely lives, eats, sleeps, brings, figure of respect, respects everybody. There's not, I've been around this a long time. Players tend to treat equipment guys, trainers, video guys, is kind of like, you know, underlings that, you know, there to do stuff for them. Not Drew Brees. Drew Brees treats the secretary, the server in the cafeteria, the trainer, the equipment guy, not just the head equipment guy, but the guy that's just the guy lying in the field. He knows all their names. He's constantly thanking them. He's doing little things for them, I'm told, to help them out. He's just the classiest person in the league. If you wanted, he is the type of guy that I could see the league renaming. You would never take the Walter Payton Award away from Walter Payton's name. But if you want to put somebody that was kind of the angel, the player with the angel, it would be Drew Brees. Ironically, in playing for the Saints. And he's, in addition to that, a great football player too. And so he was and has been a godsend for the Saints. He's been as good a quarterback as we've seen, maybe ever, one of the best. I can tell you personally, as a coach and as a scout for years and studying players and loving the game and living the game being my life in so many ways, my favorite player was growing up, you know, in my youth or in early stages, was Fran Tarkenton. But my favorite player to watch in the modern era has been Drew Brees. So to watch the game last night and to see him break records is one thing, but it's not just him breaking the records, but to study him as well as I have and as long as I have and as hard as I have to see him and how he does things. The little things that he does are phenomenal. He's known to, on bye weeks, and he'll probably do it this week. They don't have a game this week. So Sunday at noon at the Saints facility, he'll be out there by himself. Everybody else will be gone. He'll be out there, and he will literally just get to have a football, you know, go through a simulated game plan. What you would call route progressions, go through his reads, make a throw, go through the whole thing, and he goes through the whole game. He is meticulous in his detail, and it is the epitome of everything that I try to explain every year when talking about players. It is the intangibles, folks. You have to have the tangibles. Without the tangibles, you're really not developing anything. You don't have the ability to do certain things. But when you have the baseline ability to do things and to play, it is the intangibles. It is the work ethic. It is the absolute desire to be the best. That's what separates good players from great ones. So when we talk about the next generation of guys, you know, if you're a fan of Baker Mayfield or Sam Darnold or Josh Rosen or Josh Allen or Carson Wentz or Jared Goff or Deshaun Watson or Patrick Mahomes or anybody of these younger guys, you want to know who's going to be the best? The ones that approach the game that way are going to be the best. And it takes some luck from a health standpoint. But Drew Brees is an example of a guy that even a health issue that would have knocked down for the count wasn't enough to knock him down. Very impressive performance in regards to the game. I thought the Saints did a phenomenal job with their five-man pressures. They had injuries in coverage. They had problems in coverage due to injuries, I should say. But they got good pressure. Washington Alex Smith just was not able to attack vertically. And I thought the Saints did a good job, particularly in zone coverage coming up, tackling fairly well. Did a really good job. Marcus Davenport starting to play pretty well. Mark Ingram, big impact to help the defense by being able to control this game offensively. Very impressive down the stretch, wasn't it? Like 7-minute drive. They didn't need to score any more points. But they're in such good position now. This is going to be a team, fun team to watch. We'll see what they can do. They can get Lattimore back and improve a little bit defensively. This is going to be definitely the team to beat in the NFC South. Carolina is the only other team that seems to have a pulse. I know the Bucs are 2-2, but that is going to slowly but surely fall by the wayside. This past week, New England's gotten back on track, haven't they? Well, against the Colts, they're getting some pieces back on offense. Still the team to beat in the NFC East. Tennessee, again, dealing with prosperity, going on the road to Buffalo, didn't play well. Josh Allen doing a nice job was a problem there. Miami. Just goes to show you, even in a game, if you watch games and study games, you see the flow of a game change. Miami was outplaying Cincinnati for a half. A couple of huge mistakes, costly. Folks, 2 pick-6 tip balls. Miami lost to Cincinnati. That's where the game was decided. Cincinnati, I'm telling you, Joe Mixon's running the football well. Quarterback's playing pretty good, too. I got to tell you. Andy Dalton's playing good football for the Bengals. And A.J. Green's playing well. This is a good football team. This team's maybe a little bit better than people know. Going to be interesting to see this week. Pittsburgh goes to Cincinnati. And I like the way this Cincinnati team's playing. Pittsburgh's still in a desperation mode. Going to be a lot of fun. Baltimore, Cleveland. Cleveland finding a way here. Defense playing well. Offensively, still not very good. Baltimore, just can't trust them on offense. Green Bay, you know, folks, Green Bay's defense is playing better than you might know. It's the offense that's giving them trouble. I don't know what to get from Detroit week in and week out. Play well, play poorly. Just kind of hard to figure them out. Kansas City, impressive. Stood up defensively, made some plays. Bortles was awful for Jacksonville. That's the concern you'd have. In the playoffs, are you going to get a Blake Bortles game? You're going to go home. For Kansas City, it would be, can you get off the field defensively against a good offense? Jets were outstanding, dominated Denver. And breaking down the tape, it really surprised me. You know, when you watch a bunch of games at one time, you have a feel for it. But when you break down the tape, you see the true dominance. I thought the Jets dominated up front defensively, breaking down Denver's protections, really getting a lot of pressure on the quarterback. Offensively, Jets blocked the Broncos front. Very impressive. They dominated this game. Donald was outstanding. Kroll, Powell. Very good run on the football. They had a number of explosive plays. Just an overall outstanding performance by the Jets. Denver, you know, coaching's an issue, no doubt. Quarterback's an issue. Offensive line. I said it years ago, and, you know, the Denver media just genuflex at John Elway, and I rankled people when I said years ago, without other than recruiting Peyton Manning, there's not a whole lot John Elway's done for that organization. Since his playing days, of course, he was a great player. But, you know, largely the defensive talent was drafted by the coaching staffs. And the areas where John's been involved, he's really failed at quarterback, hasn't fixed the offensive line. And, you know, how many coaches does he get to hire? People keep blaming it over there on the coaches. Yeah, who's hiring the coaches? It's amazing. But when you're John Elway, you don't have to stand up and take accountability. You're not held accountable in the Denver media for it. Atlanta's in a world of hurt. Pittsburgh, good win, taking care of business. Oh, the Giants. Carolina comes back to beat them. The Giants fought their way back in the game. The Giants are just making too many mistakes. And, you know, Odell Beckham, you know, what do I always say? You don't win in this league with characters. You lead with character. And Odell has always been a selfish, me-first guy. He seemed pretty pleased by the results last week. He thought that his calling out his coaches and his team and his teammates was a good thing. He thinks that's being a leader. I think the Giants are going to regret, as talented as Odell is, they're going to regret paying him that type of money. It's as simple as you got to know how to be a leader. And this kid's not a leader. I coached his dad in college. His dad was a selfish, you know, person with a lot of emotional issues. Odell's the same way. Raiders still struggling to figure out things. Red zone issues. Derek Carr throwing a pick there. Chargers getting it done. The Raiders have just got to play cleaner football. Got to find a way to finish. Finish drives, finish games. Vikings get a big one on the road. Eagles is not playing very good football at all, but I do feel like they're the team to beat in the East. Still do, because of the roster, and no one else is going to win the East. Washington's not good enough. Dallas is not good enough. The Giants are basically out of it. The Eagles are the ones that have a chance to get back into play. The north of the NFC has suddenly become the most intriguing for me. Minnesota's a better team than they've played, than they've looked. Played pretty well last week. Defense stepped up and made some plays. Receivers are good. I thought Cousins was outstanding. Looking at Cousins and what he can do, and look at what the Redskins have with Alex Smith, it's just amazing to me that you have Cousins in your building and you decide, no, but we're going to go get Alex Smith, who I like, just not as good as Kirk Cousins. That's why the Redskins are rudderless from a head coaching standpoint and a general manager in Bruce Allen that's more politician than he is, like his brother, than he is football guy. Just really bad decision after bad decision there. The North is going to be interesting, though. Green Bay's got to figure out some things on offense. And Detroit is dangerous on any given game. Chicago's just pretty doggone good. It's going to be fun. Going to be fun to watch that division. Arizona, good for them. They get a win. You don't like anybody to keep losing, and it hangs over them. You know, San Francisco, certainly, with their injuries to Garoppolo, they're going to struggle. They're going to struggle all year. And so you're looking at a division now that is clearly the Rams division, and we'll see what Seattle can do. Seattle, as I thought at home, would play the Rams well. To kind of see where they are. They're going to be chasing the Rams, and I think it's the Rams division. And I don't think there's going to be a wild card team coming out of it. We'll see if Seattle can change that perception. Dallas is Dallas. That, you know what? They've got some guys making some plays on defense. But the offensive line is not playing as well because they're not as healthy. They're not well coached on offense. They don't have any playmakers on offense. This is a team that typically with Dallas, we talk about it all the time. They're poorly constructed, and it kills them time after time. Houston shows some signs of life. We'll see if they can. They still are so bad on the offensive line that it's not sustainable. But we'll see. We've got a big weekend this weekend. We're going to talk a lot about Chicago, Miami. Kansas City, New England is the feature game on Sunday night. What a game that's going to be. Jacksonville, Dallas. Rams, Denver. Tampa, Atlanta. Chargers go to Cleveland. Seattle go to Oakland. Arizona goes to Minnesota. Indianapolis to Jets. Carolina goes to Washington. Buffalo to Houston. Baltimore to Tennessee. And Monday night, San Francisco, Green Bay. Two teams that, again, are struggling. We'll break down the matchups on Thursday of this next week. I want to answer a couple questions in transition to some college football conversation from this past week. Matt asks, the firing of Mike Stoops wasn't a surprise. In your assessment, how much of the Sooners' poor defense can be blamed on him, and how much is the nature of Big 12 defensive schemes? It's, Matt, the nature of Big 12 personnel. The schemes on offense are going to detract from your ability to be really good on defense. If you're going to be up-tempo, your defenses are going to be on the field more, and you're going to have a problem. You ask if Oklahoma recruited defense like Alabama or Oklahoma State, could they still dominate defensively in the Big 12? First of all, it's not about recruiting like Alabama and Oklahoma State. It's about recruiting in your style of play. If they recruited like them and got the same type of players and still ran up-tempo, their defenses would be better, but they wouldn't be great. I think the model for Oklahoma, is not like Alabama. They're not like Ohio State. Oklahoma, to me, their motto should be Clemson. Clemson, ironically, with former Sooner defensive coordinator Brent Venables running the defense for the Tigers. They're good because they get great talent. They get a lot of them. And they play to that style. They'll give up some plays. They're aggressive. They come after you, but they have a lot of talent, and they're going to play up-tempo offense. That should be their motto. So the answer to your question is they don't have guys on defense at Oklahoma that are very good. I mean, look at them on defense. What difference-making players do they have on defense? If you're looking at Big 12 start in the league, I mean, who's really on the defensive side that should sit there and say, yeah, this guy be – I mean, Kansas has more first-team defensive players preseason than Oklahoma. No, they're not good. I think you see TCU, pretty good defensive team, well-coached. They give up a lot of points. So, no, you're not going to change the dynamic. You're not going to put Ruffin McNeil in there, and the defense is going to change dramatically. Because it's not a schematic issue. Now, I don't think Mike Stoops did a really good job. I think it's the best thing that they part ways. But what needs to happen at Oklahoma is they need to recruit better defensive players. They need to recruit at a high level, like a Clemson. And they need to score points in that league, no doubt. But they've got to have people that can get off the field defensively. This kind of leads me into my topic I'm going to talk about is Texas. Texas is building a defense. They're not there yet, but they're starting to build a defense that looks like it could be the best in the Big 12. And to me, if you're going to make some noise in that conference, build a defense that can match up. Now, how do you build a defense? Well, you better be good in nickel. You better have a lot of players in the secondary that can cover and then come down and defend the run in space. But you better have a lot of pass rushers. So, to me, the challenge for Oklahoma is to be able to get out there and recruit that type of player to the point where you can be competitive to complement your offense. Richard asks, what stood out to you in the Florida LSU game? Well, I'll answer that since we're going to talk about it anyway. What stood out to me is the job that Dan Mullen and his staff did offensively with less personnel out coaching Dave Aranda and LSU's defense. They got the better of them. There wasn't a whole lot there. There wasn't a whole lot for Florida to be able to take advantage of. But they got the ball out of hands of Felipe Franks quickly. They attacked the edges. They ran a little option. LSU likes to play nickel. They ran power at LSU, optioned the edge defender, and just got enough out of the offense, out of the running game, to have success. It stood out to me that Florida was not only the better coach team, the more physical team, they attacked LSU's protections. They put a lot of pressure on Burrow. Receivers didn't have a lot of time to get open, didn't do a very good job of getting open. I thought Florida was a better defensive team. Thought they had more studs making plays up front than did LSU. And they affected the quarterback more than LSU affected Felipe Franks. Very impressive performance by the Gators. As I said before, repeatedly, Dan Mullen's one hell of a football coach. And the longer he gets a hold of the players, listen, it's not going to be perfect, folks. He's not going to win every game. So I just am find it extremely comical when people or the same people are questioning after the Florida Gamecocks can't coach. You didn't do a very good job in Mississippi State. Really? Do you watch football or are you just that dumb that you don't know what you're watching? Guy's a great football coach. Not a good one, a great one. Todd Grantham did a really good job. Todd Grantham has done a really good job against LSU's offenses. Now at Florida, he did it at Mississippi State. He did it at Louisville. He's caused a lot of problems against LSU. Florida's variable is their ability to recruit. If they can recruit like Georgia, they're going to play and win like Georgia. If they don't, they'll fall slightly short. But from a coaching standpoint, they can match up with against anybody. They're really, really good. Richard also asks, what are your thoughts on what is rough in the past and what is not? Listen, it's no thoughts. It's the rules pretty clear. You can't go high on them. You can't go too low. And you can't fall on top of them. You can't use your helmet. You can't leave with your head. It's pretty simple what is or what isn't. To me, the variable is the degree of intent, which you can't measure intent, but you can see the flagrancy of which they do it. Also asked, what are the reasons that – this is Pat, last one. Pat, what are the reasons Charlie Weiss failed at Notre Dame? Charlie wasn't a very good recruiter. And Charlie was very overrated. You heard Charlie brag about his schematics. He had a schematic advantage. Charlie didn't have a schematic advantage. Charlie was average as dirt in terms of schematics. The best win he ever had at Notre Dame was his loss to USC. He was not great at developing quarterbacks. He will want to take the credit for Tom Brady. Tom Brady, it wasn't Charlie Weiss that had that type of impact on Tom Brady. Didn't recruit very well. Doesn't develop players very well. Those are the two things you have to do as a coach. It's also why he's, going to go to Kansas and say, well, he can't win at Kansas. Well, Mark Mangino won at Kansas. Mark Mangino found guys that can fit his system, his style, and he developed them very well. Now, I know he was a little hard, and that's part of it. Hadn't been anybody as good since then. And certainly Charlie Weiss is not that good of a football coach, to be honest with you, as compared to what the expectations of what he is. Some other thoughts. I'm going to pick up where I left off with Texas. I'm telling you, they're building a really good defense. It's not overreact. Just like it was an overreaction to say they were done against Maryland, I was concerned. They're playing pretty good ball right now. Oklahoma defensively, well, we saw what it led to the end with Mike Stoops. Oklahoma's got to figure some things out. This throws the Big 12 in an interesting look. Texas is a player in it. I think it's probably going to knock the Big 12 out. I don't think West Virginia is good enough to make the playoffs. And I think that Oklahoma and Texas will fall short as well. So, again, I kind of look at the Big 12 and think I'm not sure that we're going to see a Big 12 team be a playoff contender. Just like I don't see it in the Pac-12. That's what the tape tells me now. Now, folks, the tape will tell me something different, then I'm going to adjust it. West Virginia did not play well. Very, very sloppy performance against Kansas. Michigan takes care of business against Maryland. NC State, let's not count them out against Clemson. Michigan State, not a typical Mark D'Antonio team. Outplayed by Northwestern. Clemson, I thought, showed some strength coming back. People talk about the Syracuse game and certainly the quarterback situation, all the effects there. You had a week to adjust to that. I thought they did a really good job of manhandling Wake Forest. That's what they should have done to him. We talked about LSU Florida in depth. Iowa State, big win on Oklahoma State. Again, Big 12's kind of take each other up. Very impressed by the points that Iowa was able to put up on Minnesota. Colorado manages to take care of business. Miami, very unimpressive against Florida State. Getting down that much, not very impressive. Florida State's in bad way. I said it as it relates to LSU. Folks, again, everybody gets too excited and overreact. LSU wins against Miami and Auburn, not very impressive. They got beaten by Florida. They're going to lose to Georgia. They're going to lose to Alabama. And they're going to lose one more game, likely, either A&M or Mississippi State. More likely, A&M. So they're going to end up 9-3 or 10-4 or 8-4. That's what I thought they were all along. Nothing's really changed with them. But it's funny how perception is. Well, they're awful. They're not going to win. They're not going to win eight games this year. And all of a sudden, they might win. You know, they probably should win nine games. And that's kind of where they are. But again, people have these perceptions, false perceptions, and adjust it off of that. Ohio State taking care of business against Indiana. Kentucky. You know, I said it last week, concern about Kentucky fans is that they built themselves up so much to think that they could be, you know, something beyond which they've been able to accomplish to this point. Just go out and do it, folks. Quit looking for respect. Earn it. A&M was just better, matched the physicality, and got it done at home. That's what it takes to be that level of a team. You got to find a way to win on the road. Every game becomes more important and bigger the more you play it. Kentucky's still going to have a great year. Goal should be to beat Missouri and beat Vanderbilt and get to that Georgia game with one loss and end the season at 10-2. That would be great. Or you can let it just ruin you, get beat by Missouri, and now you end up, you know, with three losses on the year. You know, I mean, it's there's a big difference. So Auburn's in a world of hurt right now. Think they're regretting that extension, new deal for Gus Malzahn. Joe Moorhead got his team going. We'll see. Certainly with Fitzgerald running him as the key. Nebraska continues to be outmanned and poorly prepared. Georgia took care of business against Vanderbilt. Washington struggled more with UCLA. UCLA provided some fight. Very impressed with Notre Dame looking at the tape. They're just really physical football team. Watched the game live. Which looked at the tape, they really are a good football team. Good win by Arizona. Stanford, Utah was competitive. Good. I just don't see an impressive team coming out of the Pac-12. I'm watching Colorado. Like Colorado, they're just not what I would call a playoff caliber team. They're just not. I'm looking forward to watching Colorado against USC. Saturday night, but in Steven Montez, LaVisca Chenault, good team, not a great team. So as I'm looking at it, I'm seeing some questions about overall Pac-12 particular. Not sure about the Big 12. The ACC's only got Clemson. The Big 10, in my opinion, has got Ohio State. And whoever ends up, I think Penn State and Michigan are good. You got Notre Dame out there. It's very good. And you have the SEC, which really consists of Alabama and Georgia in terms of the national stage. But that's how it's shaping up. But I warn everybody, because I'm getting the questions, hey, and let me answer it now. What happens if? Well, let's talk about it now because it's not going to happen that way. No Alabama, Ohio State, Clemson, Notre Dame, they're all not going to remain unbeaten more than likely. Why? Because it never happens. Let's just say that it does, though, Chris. Well, I think what would happen is if Alabama wins out, they're in. Clemson wins out, they're in. Ohio State wins out, they're in. And I do believe a Notre Dame, unbeaten Notre Dame, would get in over one-loss Georgia. Do I think Georgia is better than Notre Dame? I do. But I don't know they would put them in. I think that while no one is going to tell you this, while they will deny it, there's a little bit of trying to see if they can make this as fair as possible. And there is a little preconceived idea about how good a team is or not. Do I think they put potential SEC loser like Georgia in the, and when I say loser, in the conference championship game in over an unbeaten Notre Dame? No, I don't think they'll do that. Maybe they should, because maybe Georgia's better, but I don't think they'll do that. I don't think it'll come to that. I think it'll be some other issues and other discussions and still some issues about who are the most deserving. We'll get to that in due time. But the reality is, most people don't finish out like you think they're going to. So a lot of football left. We got some games we're going to go into on Thursday. Georgia, LSU, Washington, Oregon, very underrated. Washington, Oregon is the Georgia-Auburn game of the Northwest. Michigan State, Penn State, A&M, South Carolina, Baylor, Texas. Colorado, USC, Wisconsin, Michigan. A lot of good games to get into this weekend. We're going to break it down on Thursday. Reminder, what we got for you at LandryFootball.com is even more detailed information. Film room breakdown. So the college game, the pro games. Breaking down what happened last week inside the film room. Breaking down how it transverts into this week's games. That's what we got for you at LandryFootball.com. So get all the inside information and analysis, film room breakdowns. You can catch this podcast every Tuesday and Thursday. Wednesdays, Rush the Field podcast. And you can get it for the best membership package ever for less than a magazine subscription. You can have access to a veteran coach and scout. Take you inside the film room. Folks, all 32 teams are members. And just about every major college program you can think of, excuse me, are members. Check it out today. Join us today. Got great membership packages. We appreciate you joining us today. Join us at LandryFootball.com and join us right here, the Landry Football Podcast on Thursday, right here on LandryFootball.com.
To get more of Chris's knowledge, visit and subscribe to LandryFootball.com. You can also find him on Twitter at LandryFootball. This has been Landry Football on Radio Influence. This is an In the Trenches with Ian Beckles. Quick Fix on Radio Influence.
Peyton Manning, Eli Manning, their daddy taught them to get the hell down. Okay? If you're Jimmy Garoppolo and you're in the third game of the season and you're thinking about getting a first down in the second quarter of the game and you're going to plant off your left knee and try to cut back into the grain, you won't finish the season. That's what happened. You know what Peyton Manning did? He slid 15 yards ago and he'll punt the ball. But Deshaun Watson, bro, it's the fourth or fifth week of the season. You don't need to run over anybody. Like, I remember John Elway running over somebody in the Super Bowl, but that's the Super Bowl. There's no more games after that. Other than that, you have to take care of yourself. We saw RG3 get knocked out of the – his career got knocked out pretty much. I haven't seen RG3 play in forever. Deshaun Watson won't finish the season doing what I saw him doing yesterday. He got clobbered a couple times. It's just – it's not a smart thing.
In the Trenches with Ian Beckles can be found on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, Google Play, and RadioInfluence.com.